Hello, I'm Stephen Pickford. This is number 0190, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0190. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet J.L. Witterick, who is the author of My Mother's Secrets, a true story about the Holocaust in 1939 Poland. What made her write this story?
It was just by chance that I saw a documentary on this woman and her daughter who hid Jews and a German soldier at the time. And I just thought that was so remarkable because these people are enemies of each other, and yet she hid both. And they didn't know that she was hiding. You know, each didn't know about the other. I just found that so compelling. I said to myself, somebody should write a story about this. And then one day I said, well, why not me?
Life coach and happiness expert Dominique Bertolucci is the author of The Happiness Code. People during the Great Depression were actually happier than we are today.
People are less happy than they were in the Great Depression of the 1920s. People are looking for happiness now in all the wrong places. They expect their jobs to make them happy, or they expect their children to make them happy, or they think if they spend enough money or buy enough things or go enough places, they'll be happy. And I think back in the Great Depression, people were just trying to get food on their table, keep the roof over their head, and that was all they wanted, that very basic need. And when they met that need, they felt satisfied.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and this time, Book Banter and Chris Epting follow some Moonlight Miles with the Rolling Stones, plus a look at some other pop culture books with the Epting touch to it. So if you want some satisfaction, we will start you up soon on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0190, was Stephen Pickford, who is the host and producer of the Travel World Radio Show. And you can check out their website at www.twc.ca. And thank you very much, Stephen, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, sex can be dangerous. As a matter of fact, I have two stories to start off the program that highlight this very fact. First, officers from the Zimbabwe Parks and Wildlife Management Authority reported in March that a lion had attacked a couple having sex in the bush, killing the woman and sending the man dashing down a road wearing nothing but his condom, which reduced his chances of receiving help from motorists. You know, it's very important to have safe sex, so I'm glad he was using a condom. But in Zimbabwe, perhaps safe sex should also include not doing it near lions. Just a thought. And here's the second story. Near Daytona Beach, Florida, in February, Ms. Asia Walker, age 30, driving her boyfriend around, did not resist his amorous advances and soon lost control of the car. It left the road and plowed completely through a vacant house. She was briefly hospitalized, but her boyfriend was not hurt. Oh, he must be really good. Ladies, sorry I didn't get a name for you for that story. Anyway, moving right along, thieves broke into the home of Early Johnson in Muskegon, Michigan, in February and made off with several flat-screen TVs. But what really irked him was they also stole his entire DVD pornography collection, consisting, he said, of the films of every African-American porn star since the 1970s. I'm not no scumbag guy, pervert, or nothing like that, he told a local television station. Wow, isn't there a triple negative in there somewhere? Anyway, he goes on to say, I just thought it was cool to own my own porn collection. It keeps my relationship with my fiancé fresh and tight. You get the feeling he's dating a woman with low self-esteem or perhaps daddy issues? Anyway, as soon as the news of Johnson's misfortune spread, several adult video companies donated DVDs to help restore his collection. It's so nice to see a community come together to help a person in his time of need. Touching, isn't it? Yes, indeed. Anyway, it's time to talk family values, and when I say that, of course, I'm talking about people who have none. Got a couple of stories that share that trait. First, Rachel Hope and Parker Williams, both apparently intelligent and attractive, decided to procreate and fully raise a child together, even though neither has romantic intentions toward the other. Their relationship is likened to a business one, according to a February New York Times profile, in which they do their respective biological duties separately, and then each basically outsources half the subsequent child-rearing to the other. Said another parent in a similar relationship, when you think about the concept of the village and how the village was part of child-rearing for so many cultures, it makes total sense. Yeah, sure it does. Tell it to the kid when he's in therapy by the age of 10. And the second story on family values, Robert Burton, age 34, got a 15-year prison sentence in February for forcing women into prostitution, with evidence including a police report quoting Burton's own 7-year-old son. I repeat, 7-year-old son, who was in the car with Burton and two women when Miami police stopped them. Now, the kid had earnestly identified the women by saying, "Those are my daddy's hoes." Yeah, can't wait for his dating years. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we always talk about England being the nanny state. Why? Well, stories like this. After a student was hit in the face by a flapjack at Castleview School in Carnby Island, England, the isolated incident led to a review of the texture and shape of the flapjacks, resulting in a safety-related ban on triangular flapjacks. Now, according to a quote from a spokesperson for the Health and Safety Executive, we often come across half-baked decisions taken in the name of health and safety. They went on to say that the blame for the ban was not on safety administrators, but this one takes the biscuit. The Essex County Council also indicated it did not provide any guidance to the school on the shape of their food. We're happy to make clear that flapjacks of all shapes and sizes continue to have our full backing, the safety spokesperson said. Well, you know, even though they didn't rule on this, the fact that so much time and effort went into not ruling on this speaks volumes. But then again, it's all fun and games until your breakfast food puts out an eye. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. J.L. Witterick is a first-time author who has written a true story novel of heroism during the Holocaust in 1939 Poland. The book is called My Mother's Secret. J.L., or Jenny, is on the line with us right now from Toronto. Hi, Jenny.
Hi there, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
I'm delighted. Thank you so much for asking me.
This book, My Mother's Secret, takes us back, as I mentioned, to the Holocaust in Poland in 1939. What led you to this story?
Well, you know, it was just by chance that I saw a documentary on this woman and her daughter who hid Jews and a German soldier at the time. And I just thought that was so remarkable because these people are enemies of each other, and yet she hid both. And they didn't know that she was hiding. You know, each didn't know about the other. And I just found that so compelling. I wanted to, you know, I said to myself, somebody should write a story about this. And then one day I said, well, why not me? And that's kind of how it happened, Peter.
But you've also, as I said, you're a first-time novelist, so you've never written anything before. This is this is quite a lot to bite off and chew as a first-time novel.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, but if I think back to when I was younger, I loved writing, and I just love the beauty of how words can evoke emotion in people if they're arranged in a certain way. But you know, I never pursued it because my parents were immigrants and we didn't really have financial resources. So I went through school and academic scholarships and went through business school. But now I'm circling back, and it's kind of cool because this is a bit like a dream for me to be able to write a book about something I believe in and feel strongly about, and hopefully will inspire people when they read it as well. So I guess maybe, you know, I wrote this from the heart because people who we've had read it or who have read it, and including kids from 10 years old to people over 80 years old, have loved it. And so I guess I feel grateful. I just wrote from the heart. You're right. I don't have a background in writing, so I'm fortunate and I'm grateful that people like it.
Well, there are a few cultural things at play here that I want to discuss. One of them is when you read a story or hear about a story that deals with the Holocaust, you naturally tend to assume that the person who might have written the book has a Jewish background, and you certainly do not.
Well, you're right, because sometimes, because of my last name, people don't realize that I'm Chinese. And then when they meet me, they go, "You're Chinese? And you wrote a Holocaust story? What's that about?" So I think, you know, we live in Canada, right? I live in a Jewish neighborhood, actually. And, you know, I think that has a big, impact on how we see ourselves. But also, you know, this is a story about courage and standing up for what you think is right. And you know, I think that transcends cultures.
Now, you also, you mentioned your Chinese background. Your parents your parents are immigrants. They come to Canada for the better way of life, like so many people do. So many immigrants come here.
Yes.
They put their kids through schools, or the kids put themselves through schools, and there's usually a great business sense to get things done and have a better way of life. In the back of your mind, were you always a writer who went into business school and now come back to what you really are, or is this something that developed later in life?
Well, you know, for me, writing is a hobby. It's not what I see as my main profession. Certainly, we're actually giving the proceeds of the book away to charity, so I'd probably starve to death if I didn't go down this route. But it's something that I've always wanted to do, and I wasn't sure that I'd be good at it, but it seems that people are telling me that they love it, so. I'm very encouraged by it. I just found time to do it when you know, in the evenings or on weekends or when I'm traveling in airplanes. And so I just really just squeezed little crevices out of my day to do it. And probably at this point in my life, it makes more sense for me to write a book than when I was younger anyway, because I have more experiences to offer. You know, I've had heartache. I've had things that give me more character, and I can translate that and share that through my characters in the story, and I don't think I would have had that when I was younger, so probably going this route actually in the end worked out the best.
Because I get the immigrant's mentality. I myself am a child of immigrants, and you know, when when I got into broadcasting, they're saying, yes, that's nice, when are you going to get a real job?
So, well, you're doing this job pretty well, Peter.
So I understand where that comes from. What's your family's reaction to you writing this book? And you say you live in a Jewish community. What is the reaction of the Jewish community to you writing this book?
Yeah, well, I'll answer both of them. First of all, my parents can't actually read the book because they don't read English very well. And that's sort of sad for me. So I'm hoping that it gets picked up by a publisher in Asia, and they will do the translation so that they can read it. But my father did say, and it was very touching, that he was going to sit with his English-Chinese dictionary and try to read the book that way. But, you know, the nuances of language can't be picked up that way. And so I said, just wait. I'll look into having it translated. And so they've always been very supportive, and I'm very fortunate that way. And even though we didn't have any money when I was growing up, I always felt that, you know, they were always 100% behind me, and I think, you know, that has given me a lot of self confidence to move forward in my life. In the Jewish community, I've been overwhelmed by the positive response. There was an article in the Canadian Jewish News that came out yesterday about it, and we're finding that people are saying that a lot of Holocaust books are sad. And, you know, how do you get away from that? It was a sad and dark period. But this book isn't sad. This book, when people read it, say, okay, everything that happened, is in there, but you don't focus on that. You focus on, you know, the courage and the strength and the good that actually some people displayed despite the horrors around them, and how they rose above that, and And so people that have read the book have found it inspiring and enjoyed it. And it wasn't a hardship to read it, according to some younger Jewish young adults who, you know, who said, well, I've read so much in this topic, I'm really not interested. And then when they read this book, they loved it. So I'm really thrilled about that, you know.
I grew up in the 60s, and I, too, grew up in a neighborhood that had a large Jewish community to it. So a lot of my friends growing up, their parents or their grandparents or aunts or uncles were Holocaust survivors. So I would hear about this almost daily.
But I'm just
wondering, is it even more important now to get this story out? Because we're a couple of generations removed. Unfortunately, those who had lived through this, they're dying off now. And a whole younger generation isn't necessarily aware of, even if they hear about the Holocaust, don't understand what the horrors of the Holocaust was all about.
Absolutely. I've had that from people telling me what a great service this is for that very reason. You know, I think that words are so powerful, and they can create... They can create how people see the world. And if we can get this book into the hands of young people, and this helps shape their tolerance and compassion, not just, you know, in this context, but on a greater scale, wow, you know, Peter, I'm just going to feel so great about that. And that is a big motivator for me in terms of writing this book as well. We had a quote from one guy who's actually started an exchange program in the Middle East to encourage, you know, peace initiatives. And he said, you know, he saw that he's actually going to use this book for his exchange students in the Middle East. And he said, I see great possibilities for this book to promote peace and understanding. So, you know, that was really something for me.
We mentioned a little bit, you're in the business world. You're the president of one of the largest international money managers here in Canada. When people who know you from your business side were aware that you're writing this book, or now that this book is out, are they surprised or are they saying, oh,
yeah.
That's...
They're really surprised. They're like, what? I didn't know that you really surprised us. And so yeah, absolutely. I don't think they saw this coming. But, you know, the truth is I didn't see it coming either. It was just something that I thought, you know, I should just do this. And so many of us go through life with things that we wish we'd done, right? We're not just one-dimensional. And I guess I feel extremely fortunate that, you know, I got to realize or let a part of me come out that has been dormant for a long time, and to do it in a way that people are appreciative and are enjoying is even more gratifying. So, yeah, they were pretty surprised. I actually gave them copies of the book, and what's nice is they come back and said that they really enjoyed it. So the ending's good.
Now, you mentioned that some of the proceeds to My Mother's Secret is going to charity. Tell us about that.
Well, absolutely. Any of the books sold at Chapters Indigo is going to go towards the Love of Reading Foundation, which buys books for kids in poor communities. And that really resonates with me, because when I first came to Canada, I didn't have any money for books. And we used to go to the Salvation Army and just read the books sitting on the floor. Once in a while, I'd be able to buy one for 5 cents, you know, or 10 cents. So I thought, wow, this is really great. It's like full circle again. And I feel wonderful about that. And the other thing is we also are giving money to Girls Helping Girls, which is a charity to help girls in Africa obtain education. And then ALS Research, a very good friend of mine has that, and I dedicate a book to him as well. And so we want to put some money towards that as well. So, you know, this book is about people who are good in the midst of unbelievable evil. So if the proceeds of the book can go towards doing good as well, then it's all consistent, and it makes me feel great.
The book is called My Mother's Secret. People can go to the website, which is mymotherssecret.com. Jenny, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Continued success with all that you do and this book as well.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
J.L. Witterick, author of My Mother's Secret. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0190, and you'll find links to Jenny's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to a life coach about happiness. Plus, Stuart Nelman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Well, St. Mary's County, Maryland school superintendent Michael Martirano complained that some in the media sensationalized the district's new rules, but they were pretty clear in the announcement. Effective immediately, school officials announced, parents visiting in the school cafeteria should refrain from disciplining another child. Parents visiting in the cafeteria should not hug or touch another child. Worse, the written rule noted, registered volunteers may play or interact only with their own child, i.e., pushing on a swing. Registered volunteers may interact with their children and should not engage in prolonged conversation or play with other students. Also, no homemade food could be given to any child but their own. Backlash was immediate, even from the school board. If a student wants to hug me, I'm going to hug him back, declared school board member Kathy Allen. Martirano blamed low-level officials for implementing the rules, saying they were merely a compilation of a summary of discussions. The only problem with that contention, when the document was released, Martirano himself brushed away objections, saying that we're not violating anybody's rights, and confirming that the school district's attorney had given the thumbs up. You know, he wouldn't be much of a senior bureaucrat if he couldn't talk out of both sides of his mouth the way he just did, but I digress. Anyway, a persevering Brooklyn, New York high school teacher, Ronald Grassel, finally relented and submitted himself to a psychiatric evaluation that had originally been ordered in 1997 after he angrily and overenthusiastically dumped teachers' unions literature in his principal's office. Now, Grassel had refused the exam and had been benched, and for 14 years was neither fired nor paid while he filed a series of unsuccessful legal actions to overturn the decision. According to a March New York Post report, when he finally submitted to the exam in 2011, he was declared fit, his world-class obstinacy apparently not counting against him. And in September of 2012, he was back on the job. Okay, the fact that after all of this, he was not declared crazy means that the rest of us have to be. Yeah. Okay, the Las Vegas Denny's has opened the chain's first wedding chapel with $95 buying space for the ceremony, a bottle of champagne, and a pancake puppy's cake. The Denny's wedding chapel officially opened for business this week, and the restaurant said wedding parties will receive 20% off their food bills. Oh, man. I mean, this is sad and pathetic in just so many levels. But, by the way, I don't know about you, but I don't know anybody who actually goes to Denny's. I mean, what usually happens is you think of all the places you want to eat, and then you sadly just end up at Denny's. It's never really anyone's first choice, is it? A California Highway Patrol officer told his dispatcher, "I'm stopping the Easter Bunny." Sure enough, the day before Easter, Officer Adam Griffiths pulled over a man dressed in a bunny costume, riding a red motorcycle with sidecar on the freeway through La Mesa. The CHP released a photo another officer took of the unidentified man being lectured by the officer. It spread like wildfire on social media. Griffiths stopped the motorcyclist on westbound Interstate 8 for not wearing a helmet, a department spokesperson said. Instead, he was wearing his giant rabbit head. His outfit was a visual impairment, the spokesperson said. He was not able to be aware of his surroundings, and therefore he threatened his own safety and that of others. The giant bunny was on his way to a charity appearance and was let go with a warning. He then hopped away, the news report concluded, with his head in the sidecar. I'm just wondering, where does a giant rabbit keep his license and registration anyway? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Bradford City, Pennsylvania police were summoned to a home on a report of a gunshot victim. They arrived to find Alfredo Fortunato Malaspini III, age 31, with a gunshot wound to his hand. It was no accident, police say. He shot himself on purpose. Alfredo was also highly intoxicated and was trying to get rid of his wedding ring, but couldn't get it off his finger and therefore decided to shoot it off. Investigators say his finger was nearly severed, but they found his ring was still on his finger. I like to see people stay together. I'm kind of romantic that way, but I think in this case, I would advocate that Alfredo should perhaps think about a divorce. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Australia is one of the happiest countries in the world. The United States and possibly Canada, not so much. Most people are waiting for that one thing that will make them happy. More money, a great job, the perfect relationship. But life coach and happiness expert Dominique Bertolucci says we're doing it all wrong. Dominique joins us via Skype-to-Skype communication from London, England. Hi, Dominique.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So why is it that we're not as happy as, say, you find folks from Australia?
Well, I think that happiness begins with a choice. And I think that one of the things that we're very good at doing in Australia is choosing to be happy. And then making a whole lot of decisions around our lives that support this fundamental choice to be happy. So we make choices that will help us to live a happy life. We have this saying in Australia that we're the lucky country. And it actually came from some politician's speech in the 50s. But, you know, all of these years later, people kind of wander along going, yeah, but, you know, we're the lucky country. And so I think regardless of what's going on, we have this belief set that then, you know, we take within and apply to our own lives as well. So we choose to be happy and then we adopt a mindset that supports that.
I know these numbers came from a recent poll, but is this something that has changed over the while? In other words, has the rest of the industrialized world become less happy than perhaps they used to be?
Well, it's very interesting, actually. Another piece of research found that people are less happy than they were in the Great Depression of the 1920s. People were happier back then than they are now. And one of those reasons is that people are looking for happiness now in all the wrong places. You know, they're looking for happiness. They expect their jobs to make them happy, or they expect their children to make them happy. Or they think if they, spend enough money or buy enough things or go enough places, they'll be happy. And I think back in the Great Depression, people were just trying to get food on their table, keep the roof over their head, and that was all they wanted, that very basic need. And when they met that need, they felt satisfied. And I think now, because most people live a life of such abundance, we forget to look for happiness in the right places, and we go chasing it all over town instead.
Is part of the problem that there seems to be, even when you look back at the Depression, for instance, people thought that even though the Depression was taking place, it would at some point come to an end. Is there a lack of hope today for a lot of people?
Well, I think for a lot of people today, the current economic climate is the most difficult time of their life so far. If you take my peer group, I'm in my early 40s. We were too young to know anything of Vietnam. And so the current economic climate is the first time that we've kind of been hit by tough times. And I think that for a lot of people, we're taking it badly and we're taking it to heart and we're thinking it will never end, instead of appreciating the level of abundance we still have in our lives. You know, most people are still able to put food on the table. Most people are still able to keep the roof over their head. Most people have clothes. They're able to provide their children with education, and those fundamental needs are being met. But we've had it so good for so long that I think the current climate is allowing people to sort of emotionally throw in the towel a little.
Well, we should mention your book. The book is called The Happiness Code, 10 Keys to Being the Best That You Can Be, or Best You Can Be. So how do we go about, we being those of us in North America and those in the UK, how do we go about being as happy as you find Aussies?
Well, I think, as I mentioned already, the first thing you need to do is to choose to be happy. And, you know, I don't mean that in a sort of a glib way. I really mean that in this deep way. You know, make a decision to be a happy person. And then follow that through in all of the choices that you make. You know, happiness isn't something you can wake up and say, I think I'll try being happy next Tuesday. How does 3 p.m. sound? You know, you really need to be thinking about it all the time. And you can't expect to make poor choices in your life and result in happiness. You know, I know somebody who is dating a married man, and she wonders why she's not happy. Well, I'm not placing any moral judgments on that, but I'm thinking about, when you think about what it's going to take to make you happy, that is not a choice that supports happiness. Likewise, if you don't take care of your physicality, you know, you don't exercise regularly, or you eat, a lot of junk food, or you won't feel good in your body, that's not a choice that will make you happy. So I think the first thing that people need to do is to make the choice to be happy, and then to follow that through with a series of actions.
Is it a possibility that some people are sabotaging themselves? By that I mean some people don't feel deep inside that they deserve to be happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the other thing that people do is they're putting so much pressure on themselves to be perfect. And they think that one of the reasons I wrote this book was because I kept hearing my clients criticize themselves and judging themselves and using the desire for personal improvement as a way of beating themselves up. And so I wrote The Happiness Code, 10 Keys to Being the Best You Can Be, to explain to people, what does it mean to be the best you can be? Because it doesn't mean being perfect, because you'll never be perfect. And all trying to be perfect will do is erode your self-esteem and leave you feeling worse about yourself.
Happiness can't come from outside. It's got to come from within, right? Because as I said in the introduction, either more money, a great job, or a perfect relationship, things or other people can't really make you happy.
Absolutely. And I say the same to people all the time about children. Children bring a lot of joy, don't get me wrong, but they create a lot of work. And your children won't make you happy unless you're already happy. And it's not their responsibility to make you happier. You know, a lover, a partner, a husband or a wife can't make you happy. They can give you a happy moment, share a happy experience, but you need to bring happiness to the table, and you need to find it deep within, and you need to... The whole thing behind the 10 keys to being the best you can be is a series of principles or behaviors you can adopt so that you'll be happy regardless of what's going on in your life. And I don't mean sort of euphoric, oh, wow, this is the best minute of my life. I mean that deep, calm, quiet sense of contentment and fulfillment and satisfaction in who you are and the life you're living.
Okay, so you've written the book, The Happiness Code, 10 Keys to Being the Best You Can Be, and you are a life coach. you must at some point come across people that are quite the challenge for you in either on your book tours or in your professional business, people that are just gloomy gusses.
Well, fortunately, in my coaching practice, I don't work with any gloomy gusses. One of the great things about life coaching, as opposed to counseling or the psychology-based disciplines, is we only work with people who are emotionally healthy. So if you think of your emotional well-being as a state of, from 0 to 10, where, you know, 0 is call the men in the, with the white coats and 10 is hi, I'm Anthony Robbins. We only work with people who are already at a stage of 5. They already are emotionally healthy and are fundamentally feeling okay about themselves and their lives. They might be unhappy with things as they are right now, but they still have hope.
Okay, so for the gloomy gusses out there,
yes,
what do you think their first step should be, you know, right after buying your book, The Happiness Code?
Absolutely. Well, I'm really glad that the gloomy gusses out there have gone and bought The Happiness Code. I think that's a brilliant first step for them to take. I think the first thing they need to do is, rather than think, oh my goodness, my life is miserable, how will I ever change it? It's just ask themselves, what is one small thing I could do that would make me feel a tiny little bit happier? Could be something really simple, like clearing up my desk because that mess has been driving me insane. And then you clear your desk and you think, oh, that feels nice. That feels a lot better, doesn't it? So what is one small thing you can do that will leave you feeling a little bit happier rather than, oh my goodness, I need to overhaul my life? Then when you've done that small thing and you feel a little bit happier, you can go and do another small thing and feel a little bit happier again. And I think these small steps are a far better way of getting into the discipline of happy behaviors and a happy mindset than trying to, you know, overhaul your life overnight.
Just hearing you say that, I'm sure there are people out there listening right now who always think of the big picture, that is the where they want to get to, without thinking of the small steps it might take to get there. And you're saying, take those small steps first.
Take those small steps. And you know, it's such a cliche, you know, life is a journey, not a destination. But it's true. And I guess that's why things become cliches. And so, you know, if you think, you know, you're saying to yourself, well, I'm going to be happy when I become whatever promotion it is you're chasing. Well, if somebody else gets that promotion, are you going to allow that to be the only thing that was going to make you happy? Instead of saying, you know, I'm going to be happy when I do a good job at work, when I hand in a report that feels good, you know, when I provide my family with healthy meals, when I take the dog for a walk, when I do all of those little things that are within my control, I will be happy with myself, with who I am and the life I live.
I just usually tend to say, I'll be happy if I wake up.
Yes, well, you know, this is the thing, you know, it is, we are really very fortunate to be alive in this time, you know, in this time of the world. And yes, things may be tougher than they were 10 years ago. It's definitely tougher than they were 20 years ago. But another thing, you know, I often say to my clients, if this is as bad as it ever gets, how bad is it really? And I think that's one of the keys, is this whole idea of expecting the best and taking a positive perspective. And when you hold that positive perspective, you'll see more opportunities and more ways to create happiness in your life.
Do you think, certainly in parts of the industrialized world, like where you are in London, here in North America, that part of the problem is we tend to have a sense of entitlement?
Absolutely. And even more so when we look at Gen Y. One of my esteemed colleagues, Peter Sheehan, talks about Gen Y as having self-esteem on steroids. You know, they were raised being told by their parents how good they were and how they were worth it and what they deserved. And I think the rest of us have that to an extent as well. And I think one of the things with happiness is that you need to make the choice to be happy, but you don't just make it once. You don't say, oh, I've decided to be happy and I'm going to be happy and I deserve to be happy. What you need to do is each and every day continue to make that choice and continue to back it up with actions. So yes, you deserve to be happy, and it's a human right, and that's why the United Nations has been doing a lot of research into happiness in different nations and causes of happiness and impacts of happiness, both on individual well-being but also economic impacts of happiness. So we do deserve to be happy, but it's also so you have to earn. And you have to earn it through taking the actions and through applying the principles and by being a happy person. You know, happiness isn't a state of doing or of having, it's a state of being.
The book is called The Happiness Code, 10 Keys to Being the Best You Can Be, written by Dominique Bertolucci. And people can check out the website at dominiquebertolucci.com. I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Life coach and happiness expert Dominique Bertolucci. Her book again is The Happiness Code, 10 Keys to Be the Best You Can Be. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0190, and you'll find links to Dominique's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine this situation. You're the volunteer coach for your son or daughter's Little League baseball team, and it's time to fill out the roster. Your regular center fielder has the flu, so you put another player there. A batter hits a pop fly to center, but the fielder misses it and gets hit in the eye. What do you do? Well, how about call a lawyer? Several years ago, the president of Little League Baseball told Congress that very story to reveal how bad America's problem with lawsuits has become. In that case, the player's parents sued for medical costs, pain and suffering, and punitive damages, too. All because of a mishandled pop fly. Let's be fair. Sometimes it seems that America's new national pastime is filing lawsuits. A new lawsuit is filed every 2 seconds, and unless the courts solve this problem, it may get to the point where the only people qualified to coach Little League are moms and dads with a law degree. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we're turning the page with Stuart Nolman. It's another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And I can get no satisfaction.
Really?
Yes.
Is that something personally you want to discuss, or are you on the Rolling Stones bender?
No, I'm on a Rolling Stones bender. Okay. That's sort of like the bridge that segues into this review on this edition of Book Banter.
It's interesting because 2 weeks ago we talked about Whitney Houston, so this time we're talking about the Rolling Stones. It's a musical genre. You know, actually, if you want to look at the coincidences, you're talking about someone who unfortunately has died too young to members of the group who you sometimes wonder how they're still alive.
Especially Keith Richards.
Well, that's who I was thinking of, yes.
But I'm aware they had their share of tragedy too. Look at Brian Jones, who passed away in 1969.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So who died, you know, before his time as well, and who knows what could have happened if he would have got his act straight and, you know, stayed with the group. You don't know. But let me tell you about the Rolling Stones in general and Chris Epting.
Chris Epting, a very good friend of this show. Who was on not too long ago. I'm assuming then you're talking about Moonlight Miles.
Oh, yes, because you know what? Author Chris Epting, he's a pop culture traveler. Let's put it this way. And for years, he's traveled the length and breadth of the United States from coast to coast in search of the still standing and disappearing landmarks of American pop culture. He searches for the places where significant events happened, as well as where TV, movie, and rock music stars performed, lived, and died. Now, like the typical archaeologist whose concrete proof of his discoveries are the ancient artifacts that are dug up and ready for a display in a museum, Epting's discoveries are usually marked by photographs of these sites, along with thorough research of the stories behind these familiar and not so familiar pop culture landmarks. And his discoveries have transcended into a series of fascinating books that are like travel guides with a big difference, such as James Dean Died Here and Roadside Baseball. Now, in his latest book of this nature, which is exclusively available as an ebook, Epting retraces the steps that were made across America by the world's greatest rock roll band, yes, the Rolling Stones, which is called Moonlight Miles. And the book covers the period from their first visit to America as the antithesis of the Beatles in 1964 to their Tattoo U tour of 1981. And like his other books, Epting journeys across America to find the significant and insignificant sites, only this time he is in search of the places that shaped the tumultuous history of the Stones in America during their formative years. So we go on a cross-country guided tour of the Rolling Stones America. We visit the old Boston Garden, where during their turbulent 1972 tour, which happened, you know, at the same time as the Montreal Forum Tour, where the van blew up and the riot happened.
Right.
This is where the group arrived with a police escort after they were arrested in Rhode Island for assaulting and obstructing police work. And after opening act, Stevie Wonder played an extended set, keeping the garden bands at bay. Then there's the Fort Harrison Hotel in Clearwater, Florida, where Keith Richards woke up in the middle of the night with a guitar riff in his head, got his guitar, wrote down the riff's notes, and went back to sleep. That riff later became the famous opening riff for their first big hit, Satisfaction. Hmm. And, of course, there is Altamont, the Livermore, California Raceway, where the Rolling Stones' most controversial concert took place. That was supposed to be a free concert as a thank you gesture by the Stones to their fans. But thanks to the miscalculation of using members of the Hell's Angels as security, it ended up with the violent death of 18-year-old spectator Meredith Hunter. Now, the book is filled with plenty of great research and never-before-heard anecdotes that further add to the legend that is the Rolling Stones, as they left their mark in America in more ways than one. There's plenty of then-and-now photos of some of the sites that Epting visited during the course of his research. And also, there's some interesting trivia, like he adds some playlists of selected Stones concerts throughout the 17-year period that's covered in the book. Like, for example, a typical playlist from their inaugural 1964 American tour included cover versions of songs by Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and Buddy Holly, who were their main influences. So Moonlight Miles is quite an entertaining pop culture road trip that Rolling Stones fans will certainly want to follow Epting's example and discover the places where Mick, Keith, Brian, Charlie, Bill, and Ron changed the face of rock music during their unique brand of British invasion. Now, as a result, fans will certainly get plenty of satisfaction reading this book.
And you know, the one thing that's great about Chris Epting is if you ever have a chance to talk to him, and I think you have had that chance as well, correct?
Unfortunately, I've contacted him through email.
Okay, actually, so you haven't talked to him. When you talk to Chris, you hear in his voice the passion and exuberance for the topic, the subject matter of whatever he's writing about at the time. He truly, truly loves what he does. He talks to you, you know, like an excited child who wants to tell you a story because of something he or she just experienced.
I know, and you know what? He has so many, great stories.
Yeah.
I mean, not only of pop culture in general, but also his experiences.
Exactly. He loves to research and write about that stuff. And that shows in his books. If you're in any way, shape, or form remotely interested in the kind of stuff he writes about, then you have to read what Chris writes.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? Other books that he has written that I highly recommend, and there's quite a lot.
Yes.
Is the first book that started it all, James Dean Died Here. And also his autobiography, Hello, It's Me, which shows why he got to the path that he pursues right now. And what a great path, let me tell you. And I mean, these are memories that he recounts in this book that anyone that of us have certain places that share a special meaning for us. And also our brushes with celebrity, whether it be accidental or intentional.
His meeting with Alfred Hitchcock is classic.
Yeah, yeah. He was
a little boy, and he literally bumped into Alfred Hitchcock, and anybody who wants to know that story, find the book.
Yeah, read Hello, It's Me. It's all in there.
Okay. And this current book is called
Moonlight Miles, and it's by Chris Epting, and it's available as an ebook through Miniver Press, and it's only $2.99.
Can't beat the price.
No, you certainly can't, and it's great entertainment value, let me tell you.
And how do people find you?
Well, until I write my own ebook, you could read me in the West End Times in print every Saturday or online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We still do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I got a couple more Stuff File news stories to get to and share with you before we get to that juncture of the program. The FBI received a tip that a Facebook user was seeking to pay for an assassination of someone in Cleveland, Ohio, An agent posed as a hitman and corresponded online with the individual. The Facebook user, later identified as Meredith Lowell, age 28, allegedly told the agent she wanted him to kill someone, anyone, who was wearing fur outside the Cleveland Heights, University Heights Public Library. Lowell allegedly wrote in a message, "I am paying you to kill one person wearing fur who is 12 or older, but hopefully at least 14 years. However, 12 years old or older is fine." The report also indicates Lowell wanted to be present for the killing so that she could hand out anti-fur industry literature. A psychological report found her mentally incompetent to stand trial and not capable of being rehabilitated to competency, so the judge freed her. Yes, the judge freed her. So, folks, she's still out there, and one day the fur will fly. If merely being crazy, by the way, gets people out of jail, a lot of people in jail wouldn't be there. Okay? And police on the south side of Chicago have been plagued with fake 911 calls, such as reports of shootings which result in heavy responses by officers to the detriment of actual calls. They couldn't be traced since they were from an unregistered cell phone. After a person with a gun call, which described the suspect as wearing a black jacket with Chiefs on the back, an officer spotted a man wearing just that and detained him. The call proved false, but by that time the man had been patted down and the officer found drugs on him. The man also had a cell phone and the officer used it to call 911, and sure enough, it was the same one that had made the fake calls. Kalen McDonald, age 19, said he made the calls because the heavy response made gang members in the area scatter, and was charged with drug offenses and felony false reporting. Police got no explanation as to why McDonald described himself when calling in the shooting. Not a bright boy, that one. Now, I could have easily made him the idiot of the day, but I didn't. And, you know, there are a few reasons why I didn't make him the idiot of the day. He's not a complete moron. Let's just merely call him, for the purposes of this story, a half-wit. Because, yes, he described himself when giving the description to the criminal on the 911 call. But his reasoning for making the 911 calls, as illegal as they were, do hold some merit. I mean, when 911 calls are made and the cops show up, actual criminals, or in this case gang members, would scatter. So, kudos for that kind of thinking, and that's probably the only reason I didn't make him idiot of the day. But he did come close. But this next story, well, this is today's idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Jared Carr, age 37, was arrested in Chippewa County, Wisconsin in March after he persisted in demanding a refund for a computer printer he said he bought at a Walmart, although he did lack a receipt. Now, while examining the printer, the Walmart employee noticed a sheet of paper still inside showing two counterfeit $100 bills. The store refused to take the printer, but Carr kept insisting, so the store called police, who arrived while Carr was still haggling for a refund. Carr then allegedly physically resisted police when they tried to arrest him. When searched, they found three more of the $100 bills on his person. Carr also had several outstanding warrants. He was arrested for attempted theft by fraud, forgery, and resisting. Here's a hint, by the way. If you are given a chance to take your evidence away, take it. I mean, why would someone try to return a printer at Walmart, which still had paper in it that clearly was counterfeit money? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid. but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0190. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's number 0190. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air online or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. We're done. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.